exam a week from today, so I will do review on Tuesday. The exam on Thursday will be a mix of knowledge-based questions. Give me three ways you might measure the distance to a galaxy, that sort of thing. And, you know, numerical things you can work out and actually get a real answer quantitatively for. Those will be designed to be doable in the time allotted. So bring a calculator as well as something to write with. And you can also have a one-page formula sheet, which is 1 8.5 by 10 piece of paper, one slide only. You will keep that. All right, so we've been talking about the distance scale. That has been, you know, what I summed up in three classes. Seems like a lot now, but that used to be the entirety of a cosmology course, or a whole lot of it. And today I want to move on and talk about age constraints. That might be the other fraction of it, is how do we know how old the universe is. We have a time scale from the Hubble constant. The inverse of that is the Hubble time, which is 13 billion years, give or take, depending on what you think the actual value of that constant is. And for scale, when that was maybe it was between 50 or 100 for the Hubble constant, don't take that. We'll have to staple them together later. The stapler didn't work. For 50, the Hubble time is 20 giga years. For 100, it's 60 giga years. So there are no solutions yet. Okay. So that can be checked against the ages of things in the universe. You know, the expansion time scale is set by the Hubble constant, but then we can independently, one hopes, measure the ages of stuff in it, and presumably the contents of the universe do not have a greater age than the universe itself. And sometimes that appears to have been the case, and so that's called the age problem when it shows up. For example, there was a good while when the globular cluster stars were thought to be older, or at least nearly the old age of the universe. So going back to the early 90s, here is an age estimate that the average age of globular clusters was about 17 billion years, you know, give or take two. And this is the difference between a statistical and a systematic error. That plus or minus two is how well you can estimate the 17. That's the statistical error. The systematic error is how far off your calibration of that is. That can be bigger. What happened historically is that people looked at numbers like this. In the 80s, it was even bigger, 18, 20 billion years. And at the time, that was the most accurately measured of any of the numbers we're talking about. Much better known than the Hubble constant. We could see that the globular cluster stars were very old. And the formal accuracy for that was less, smaller than the other cosmological parameters. So then you, knowing that, you look at Sandage's H0 of 50 or the De Vaucouleurs H0 of 100. That's 20 giga years, that's 10 giga years, this is a little less than 20 giga years, so obviously that's right and that's just wrong. That kind of reasoning was endemic to the field and still is. You will still encounter that in discussions of the current Hubble tension where the difference is smaller, 67, 75, somewhere in there, but it's the same communities with the same attitude saying the same things. And probably the same ones who are wrong. They're the ones who are least willing to consider the fact that maybe they're the ones who are wrong. in the 90s, we had the precursor to Gaia, the Hipparco satellite. Its mission was also the European Space Agency mission. Its mission was to measure parallaxes, and that changed the Milky Way distance scale, made it a little smaller, and that brought down the ages. Make it smaller, I have to remember which way that goes. It brought down the ages of the globule clusters. So you say, same people, right, 6 years later, giving an average age that's way outside that formal range of uncertainty. Actually, the statistical error didn't really change much in terms of percentage terms, but the answer did, and that was entirely due to the systematic of the distance scale, not something that they were doing in their analysis of the globular clusters, but they were relying on a distance scale that had been miscalibrated. So that's an example of a systematic uncertainty. And of course, people keep working on this. Here's a recent one. Now the age estimate they give is 13.3 giga-years. And they try to estimate the statistic, but the systematic error, and think it's maybe a half giga-year. Again, this is not something you can add in Gaussian random nature with statisticals. This means the whole thing could shift one way or the other by a half a giga-year. When we do error analyses, the random error, that is the statistical error, that's pretty well defined, and so you understand that if somebody gets a one sigma error, then there's a 68% chance that the right number is within that plus or minus. That's sort of the definition of Gaussian statistics. Now, random errors may not be truly the Gaussian. In astronomy, they're usually not. They usually have a probability density, usually has a longer tail than implied by a Gaussian. But that is different. That is all something you can deal with statistically. Instead of just assuming a Gaussian, you can, in principle, go and ask, work out what the probability density is. So, when we did our Tully-Fisher H-naught study that I talked about last time, we did this, and the probability density ends up looking something like this. And so, some middle point was 75, what we recorded. But there was actually more weight to higher side. It could be 77 maybe, but then it cut off very quickly. That's not a Gaussian, right? The Gaussian distribution that one usually reports is something like that. Not the same. Doesn't have to be the same. A rule that Gaussian statistics always applies to your data. But the statistical side of it, you can deal with that way. You can actually build some kind of probability distribution and show how it deviates from a Gaussian, if it does. For the systematic uncertainties in astronomy, you don't have that ability, and you can play with the ones that you know about and say, okay, well, if I push this thing I'm assuming to an extreme, what effect does it have? And so we played that game with the calibrators. That is, what is the tip of the red giant branch that we're using to get the distance to the galaxies that we use to calibrate the Tully-Fisher relation? But if that's just wrong by what people think it might be wrong for, and you drive it to that extreme and say, okay, this is how it affects our result. And so that's usually how people do this. And when there are multiple contributors to that, and then you get different approaches to that. So you could drive them all to one extreme, and then you have basically, okay, it's in this box. That's not a one sigma thing, it's really, those are the limits that I know about. Or you can pretend like they're Gaussian random if you have multiple contributors, not just tip of the red giant branch, but uncertainty in Cepheids, uncertainty downstream from how those things were calibrated at different rungs of the distance ladder. But, you know, you could then play a game, well, they're not all going to be offset in the same direction, so it's not maximally bad, and so let's average those out. And so people do different things. There is no standard that I'm aware of for how to actually do that in practice. Actually, I have to read a paper to see how people deal with that. Which is all to say, this is just not a one-sigma error. It's, in astronomy, the most common practice is to say this is the maximum of the errors that I know about, the systematics that might drive you one way or the other. So it really is sort of a hard limit for the known unknowns. There are also unknown unknowns, and then you just don't know about them. Right, so you could still be off by more than that for reasons that you don't know about.
It's hard. Okay.
So how do we do this? I hope the HR diagram is familiar to all of you. Is that not true for anyone? This is just individual stars now, how bright they are versus their color, which is a proxy for their surface temperature. And this is an old population like this globular cluster here. Or again, you can see the red giants by eye. They're bright and reddish, and then lots of other stars. So there's the red giants, the evolved stars. There are the main sequence stars that survive, some horizontal branch stars, which is where things end up after they get past the tip of the red giant branch. They live there for a while, and then they propagate up what's called the asymptotic giant branch. To zeroth order, the main sequence turnoff point is what gets you the age. It's basically just the luminosity at that point, and that's the distance-dependent part, so you have to get the distance locally right to get the luminosity right. And how much fuel that star has to burn at that luminosity, because basically stars live on the main sequence for their main sequence lifetime, which for low-mass stars is many billions of years, and then they evolve pretty rapidly once they exhaust the hydrogen fuel in their core. So the first order, a star that spends, you know, a solar mass star spends 10 billion years at that luminosity. Yeah?
So in order to find this main sequence turnoff point for a given cluster, do you kind of take all this spectral information and fit to the HR diagram?
So this is there are a variety of ways of doing it. That's one. A cheap way of doing it is just colors. You observe it in a couple of filters, plot the brightness of one filter, and then the color is a different. A color is basically a flux ratio, how much blue versus how much green light is given. And that's all you really need to do. And then what you do is fit isochrones, theoretical models, to how that evolves to localize that point. But at zeroth order, you don't even need to know that. You can just eyeball it and say, oh, look, there's the turnoff point. And that's not good enough to publish, but it gets you the right answer to a billion years or so. So there's the turnoff point. There's the stars that are still on the main sequence. And this is a typical morphology for the HR diagram of an old stellar population like the globular cluster. So people have gone out and measured this a lot. And here I quantify a bit better the argument I just made. So a star at the main sequence turnoff point has been shining at approximately that luminosity for, you know, the time since it was formed. So the luminosity of the turnoff point is the rate at which it is burning fuel. Right? You have to produce that energy in the nuclear reactions that go on in the core of the star. Well, how much fuel do you have? That's this up here is the energy that's available for the star on the main sequence. And the time that it can live on the main sequence is just that energy budget divided by the rate at which it's burning that fuel. That's to zeroth order the argument. And you can measure the luminosity. What's trickier, and you do have to invoke theory to do, is to calculate the energy budget. So basically, the amount of energy that is available to spend in emitting this luminosity is the mass of the core. So there's the stellar mass, the fraction of the mass that's in the core, and the efficiency of hydrogen burning. An early result in stellar structure is that the fraction of a star's mass that is available to burn, that is, you know, a star is a big puffy ball of plasma, and most of the outer regions are pretty low density. It gets denser and denser and denser and hotter and hotter and hotter as you go towards the center. And the regions where it's dense enough and hot enough to burn hydrogen into helium in the core holds about 12% of the total mass of the star. And that's crammed into a much smaller radius, but there's a big density for helium. So that fraction times the total mass of the star, it's just the mc squared amount of energy available, and then you're liberating energy by hydrogen fusion, find hydrogen through the proton-proton chain, or maybe the CNO cycle, depending on the mass of the star. Into helium, that releases about 0.7% of the rest mass as energy. So that's your energy budget. And so that's how much you got to burn, that's the rate at which you're burning it, and then that's the time and so on. So you would think that top thing, that sounds kind of involved, right? You'd think that would be your major uncertainty. And in fact, this calculation can be done pretty accurately, and the big uncertainty turned out to be just the distance scale. Measure the apparent magnitude, you need to know the distance and the extinction of any dust in between to this cluster to get the luminosity right. And that was the big thing that changed here. I should say again, we talked about the progression of going from, no, we're not talking about cosmological constant at this time, to saying, oh yeah, we're good with that by this time. This was one of the many pressure points on the standard theory, is that the Hubble time for H-50 is 20 giga-years, and that is big enough to accomplish that. But remember, people then wanted omega-matter to be one. The age of that is not the Hubble time, it's two-thirds of a Hubble time, and again, that causes a problem. Because if H-naught is low, like 50, then two-thirds of that is like 13 or something, that's smaller than this. So the age problem was one of the many drivers for pushing us to adopt the cosmological constant. Turned out it wasn't really a problem, but it was a systematic error. So that was a motivation that shouldn't have been a motivation, but it was an important motivation, and we got there anyway. The history of how these things come to be matters. Okay, so that's still a fairly crude way of doing this in practice. Well, actually, you can do this really well even at this level, because stars on the main sequence have a empirically well-determined mass-luminosity relation. So in solar units, like one solar luminosity comes from one solar mass. That scales with some power law. It doesn't do that everywhere. Really low mass stars have a different power law. But over most of the main sequence, it's, L goes as M to the 3.5 or 4. Depending on what filter band you're talking about the luminosity in. But the important thing to recognize here is that this power is more than one. Right? So as a star gets more massive, it gets a lot brighter. Right? You double the mass of the star, it doesn't just get twice as bright, it gets 2 to the A brighter. If it's right, 2 to the 4th, well that's 4, 8, 16. Times brighter for a two solar mass star. What that means is that the luminosity increases with mass a lot faster than the energy available in the core. That just scales linearly with the mass. And so that gives you the main sequence lifetime relation. And that's why you get this morphology. These higher mass stars are really bright, and so they burn through their fuel faster. Peel off the main sequence sooner. So these things are just gone, and that's what makes the main sequence an age indicator. And then in detail, you don't just use that reasoning, you build stellar models. And this is the subject of Astronomy 311. But so these are evolutionary tracks for stars of different masses. That red line there is a zero age main sequence. As to say, I take a spectrum of stars, the spectrum of masses for stars and ask what their initial condition is. Once they form a locus along that red line. And then you let them evolve, and they evolve on different time scales. 15 solar mass star becomes a supergiant on a tame scale of 10 million years.
Okay, so that's pretty quick. It's a blink of a cosmic eye,
right? You're down to 5 solar masses. You're still talking, you know, 550 million years. So those high mass stars, even not super high mass stars, evolve pretty quickly. Get down to 3 solar mass stars, and okay, now we're talking about a couple hundred million years.
That's one orbital time period in the Milky Way. All right, so all those really bright OB stars, even the brighter A stars, they're not going to live long enough to even make one complete orbit.
Because there's this power law, pretty steep power law dependence of luminosity on mass, as you get to stars closer to the mass of the sun, they live a long time. So at 1.5 solar masses, it now takes a billion years before you've left the main sequence, a couple billion, to get to the top of the red giant branch. And then the sun is now up to like 10 billion. The main sequence lifetime is of the sun is around 10 billion years. And of course, it's not fair to say that in that zeroth order approximation, I said, okay, a star just sits there burning at this luminosity for its whatever its age is. That's not quite true. A star is always evolving continuously, and it starts getting brighter from the get-go. It just takes a long time for a star like the sun. So the sun was here at the zero age main sequence. After 7 billion years, it'll be up here. 10 billion years, it'll be on the subgiant branch, and then poof, another billion years later, it's at the tip of the red giant branch. So this part of the evolution is very quick. This part is very slow. But it does happen. The sun is about halfway through its main sequence lifetime, and so it's about 25% brighter than it was when it formed. So that's a long-term driver for climate change. The planet has actually gotten colder over that time, because the net atmospheric process has been to wash out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and put it into carbonate rocks and the bottoms of oceans and things. So those two things fight against each other. And the latter is, in a natural cycle, the latter has been winning. You can then take models like this calculation, and fit a track. Does this one fit better, or does that one fit better to real data for globular clusters? Here's a nice study of NGC 6205 with Hubble. It's basically the Hubble version of the I band and then the V minus I color. And so you can see this morphology, and you can even start to distinguish between, well, the outer region of the cluster is a slightly different morphology than the inner cluster. But that blue line, that is the best fit model, right? A calculation like this, specific to those bands. And so you can figure out very well what the best fit age is. If it's a little too old, this line's up here. Sorry, a little too young, the line's up here, a little too old, it's a little down there. You can do the fit very well. The trick is calibrating. So this particular work gets an age of about 14 billion years, but they say, look, it depends on whose models we adopt. For one set of models, we get 12.3, ±0.7. For a slightly different flavor of a model that also makes different assumptions about the chemical composition of the star, the age is 14.4. So the formal error is only plus or minus 0.7, but the difference, the offset, is 2 gigayears, right? So again, it depends. So to first order, all stars have the same composition, but that's not really true. Globular clusters tend to have low overall abundances compared to the sun, so that's often tagged by the metallicity, the ratio of iron to hydrogen, because that was easy to measure in the early days of people doing that. There are lots of iron mines. Easy was one of the things that was more straightforward to observe and turn into abundance. And that's how we all decided as astronomers that everything heavier than helium was a metal, because basically you had hydrogen, helium, and everything else in the star, and then more or less were traced by the iron. They all went up and down in lockstep with iron, hence the metallicity. But that turns out not to be perfectly true. There are stars that are alpha enhanced, so that alpha refers to the abundance of the so-called alpha elements, things you get by adding alpha particles to oxygen, neon, sulfur, silicon, things like that, magnesium. And those are often enhanced relative to the solar value for stars below Fe over H. So the total amount is lower, but it's not just the lockstep. Iron is down by a lot more than the alpha materials. And we know, we believe now that we understand why that is, that the iron is produced mostly in type 1a supernova explosions, and those have a longer time scale, right? You gotta make white dwarfs before you can blow them up. And so that takes billions of years before the iron production takes off. Whereas the alpha elements are made in type 2 supernovae that are those massive stars that blow up, and they blow up after 10 million years. So you can have a lot of type 2 supernova go off before the iron production kicks in. So those earlier generations of stars are alpha enhanced, as they say. All those things contribute to the opacity, which controls the structure of a star and the balance between the energy it's producing and its core getting out, gravity trying to make it collapse. And even though you're talking about percentages of percentages and differences between this element and that, it has a real impact on these kind of models. And so you can see that in the age. So. You can do better by doing it right, but then you also realize it is very hard to do better. Do better than the main sequence turnoff agent. Okay, so globular clusters are a very famous, well-established way of getting an age limit, and they all seem to have the same age. You can go out and look at globular clusters, and they're all old, and that old is 12 or 13 billion years. Now, if you're an aficionado of this, you can start to distinguish and make real, well, this one looks a little younger than that one. But for a cosmologist, they're all old.
And it's about that number.
Yeah.
This is one of those things where, like, I'm just always confused because I always just hear, like, different things. Do we understand, like, the, like, globular clusters, like, how they're formed and stuff?
To first order, yes. We understand how they evolve pretty well. To higher order, no, there are always questions. There are some globular clusters that have a second parameter effect, that there's something besides the age that differentiates between them. Some of them appear to have multiple stellar populations that are not all exactly the same age stars. So there is something more involved about them. And like I said, if you're an aficionado, you care a lot about that, because there are real differences. And so, well, what does that mean about how it formed? Did they merge or something, or were they just the first balls of gas that form stars? And to a cosmologist, they're just the first balls of gas that form stars, and they're all the same, to the uncertainty that the cosmologist cares about. If you really care about the stars, then yeah, there are lots of really interesting things. So, it's a matter of fact. So the answer is yes, there are real differences, and yes, we do understand them well enough for the purposes we're talking about. The hard part is getting this number exactly right. If you wanted to turn this into some kind of so-called precision cosmology, then you have to worry about all those details, at which point the eyes cross for those cosmologists and they go on to do something similar. My point is that there are a lot of globular clusters that are pretty much the same age, whether it's 12 or 14, okay, we can argue about that. But that's the age, and you basically never see stars older. So it really does look like there was a first epoch of star formation
that made a bunch of globular clusters, and everything else came after that. There doesn't appear to be anything before that. Right? So it's, you could imagine that, you know, people sometimes talk about cosmologies that didn't have a Big Bang, that actually contracted and then expanded again. There's nothing left over from that. Really looks like everything started from scratch about 14 billion years ago. And there are other ways you could do this. So it's not just globular clusters. That's just the most famous thing that you are likely to have heard of. So I want to tell you about some of the other age indicators so that you've at least heard of them. One is, and they're not all entirely independent, but they are different. So one of them is the white dwarf cooling curve, and you can measure the luminosity function. So you think about stellar evolution, just talking about that, right? What happens after? You evolve away a two solar mass star that happens in a few billion years and it leaves behind a white dwarf. Well, that white dwarf shines because it is the remnant of what was initially a very hot core, but it's not producing any energy, it's just radiating that energy off into space, and so it has a pretty well-defined cooling curve. How fast is it radiating that energy? Well, it basically just follows from the Stefan-Boltzmann law. Right, so the luminosity of the white dwarf is its surface area, 4 pi r squared, times Stefan-Boltzmann constant times the temperature to the fourth power. Right, so initially it's very hot, it's very luminous, but it's losing energy as it radiates. You can write down a very simple expression for that. So you can basically calculate the rate at which the temperature will drop. And it's a very strong power of temperature, T to the fourth to begin with. It depends on the size and the mass of the white dwarf, and those two are related as well. So you can calculate a cooling curve. So that's what these lines are. Here's how bright something is as a function of its surface temperature. And then these lines are isochrones, so each line is a different mass white dwarf, low mass to high mass, top to bottom. And then these lines cutting across here are the age. That is, if you put a white dwarf there, right, brand new white dwarf, it's just going to follow one of these tracks as it cools off. It's going to hit this line after only 10 million years, there's 100 million years, there's a billion years. So again, this part is very fast, and then it slows down, there's 2 billion years, 4 billion years. So what's the oldest white dwarf? Well, it's the coolest, dimmest one. You can go out and make a census of white dwarfs, count it up, and see where that ends. There should be a truncation at the faint end, where there are no white dwarfs that have had time to cool and become any less luminous. Now, of course, they're faint, so it's hard to find them, so you have to be sure you've actually done that. But people have tried. So this is an older plot. Here's a Gaia plot. It's Gaia color, and absolute magnitude. All those points are real white dwarfs. And again, you can see a lot of them follow that line for 0.6 solar masses. 0.9. So it's not like every star leaves behind something that's right on the verge of the Chandrasekhar instability. The sun isn't even big enough to do that. Its white dwarf is forecast to be about half a solar mass when it's left behind. And there are a lot of white dwarfs out there like that. This is the zeroth order physics calculation, the back of the envelope thing you can do. You do have to, in practice, worry about more complicated things like phase transitions.
As I think I mentioned before, there comes a point in the crust where carbon pressure is high enough that diamond is the most energetically favorable form of carbon. So that's a phase transition that sets in, and that eats up some of this energy budget. So you have to worry about stuff. You also have to worry, it's not a pure thermal radiator. There is a little bit of an atmosphere, and that can muck things up. Still, the basic idea is that as white dwarfs age, they fade. So here's the number density in the solar neighborhood as a function of how bright they are. So there are more and more, as you look to lower and lower magnitudes, that makes sense, right? They're just these old white dwarfs cooling off, and so they pile up down here at fainter magnitudes. So there are more and more of them because they fade as they age. But then there is a truncation, and that truncation is just because of the age. They have not had time to cool off more than that. The universe has a finite age. And so you can do this pretty well. The structure of the Milky Way at a first order distinguishes between the thin disk, the thick disk, and the stellar halo, which is a quasi-spherical distribution of stars. It's only about 1% of the total stars, but they all seem to be old, and they're not confined to the rotating disk the way the thin and the thick disk stars are. And you can actually tell the difference between the thin disk and the thick disk. So there are the data. That solid line is the combination of the thin disk, which is that dashed line, and the thick disk, which is that dotted line. So it looks like the thick disk is a little older than the thin disk. And so you will hear people say, well, the thick disk formed 8 giga years ago or something like that. Or the data are consistent with there having been an event 8 or 9 giga years that thickened the disk. You had a nice rotating disk. It got splashed by something big going by it or running into it. That heated the orbits of the stars in the Z direction, so you have this relatively thick disk, and then the stars after that settled down into a thin disk. Well, the gas did, and then it formed stars. So the thick disk and thin disk have this different age, and then you can distinguish between the stellar halo, which is what we care for an upper limit, and that's about 12.5 giga years. So the oldest things you find, you just don't think. Find things that correspond to older ages than that.
With a big uncertainty.
Right. It is hard to do this. And you can imagine you're looking for the faintest thing. So are you really seeing that turn down? Or are you just seeing the limits of your survey? I think at this point we're really seeing it, but that's always a concern. Sophia?
In the figure caption, it mentioned the deep proper motion survey. Is that Gaia, or like what are they referring to?
This was before Gaia, and they, you know, people have been trying to do this, so it was something they were themselves involved with. Gaia can do it a lot better now. But it's not like Gaia sprang out of nowhere. People have been doing this for hundreds of years. Right, but so that gives an age. Now, this age, depends on many things. There's the white dwarf cooling time, but you also have to have had time to make that dwarf white dwarf. So in addition to just how long it takes the white dwarf to cool, you have to add in something for the stellar evolution that came before that. Now for stars of a few solar masses, that's pretty short. It's like a giga year or something. So most of the information here really is from the white dwarf, but you do have to account for that, so that's an additional uncertainty. How long did it take to make the white dwarf before it started to cool? And that's wrapped into this. But having done that, you can start to distinguish the ages of different things. So this is the metallicity, solar right there. As a function of age. Note that all these numbers are big, going from 7 billion years ago, that's a long time ago, to 12, 13, 14. And you can, within this, distinguish between stars like the Sun and the solar neighborhood, which are mostly younger than 8 giga years in solar metallicity, from the thick disk stars, which formed before this thickening event, if it was a single event. So older than 8 giga years and somewhat lower metallicity, because there hadn't been as much metal production yet. That was still early in the galaxy, so on average they're low metallicity. And then the stellar halo, which looks to be even older and lower metallicity. And here are a couple of famous globular clusters. 47 Tuck is also a globular cluster, and you can tell it's different. Right? So the aficionado would say there is something different about 47 Tuck. It's one of the ones that seems to have multiple populations, and on average it's a bit younger. Calibrating this is really hard, so if you just look at the error bars, well, they're the same. And that's true and it's not, right? If all you really care about is that the universe is really old, then yeah, it's pretty much the same. Calibrating this is the hard part. Just looking at the data for this are clearly different from that. A lot different, but clearly different. You can see that. The hard part is calibrating that difference. And then there are still younger clusters and things like this. This is a so-called disk globular cluster. So one can make relative distinctions. This happens a lot in astronomy. You can say these things are a little different from that, or a little different from that. It's putting the absolute numbers on them. All right. But so now the white dwarf ages are giving us a separate measure that is consistent with what we saw from globular clusters. And it's not completely unrelated, because you do have to worry about the stellar evolution and the stars that came before. But it's mostly independent, because most of this age is dominated by the cooling time, not by the main sequence time of the progenitors. Okay, what else can we do? A really good thing to do is look at radioactive decay. This is, of course, what geologists do in the lab. You can take a sample in and measure the abundances of things, well, like carbon-14, that's a famous one. Carbon-14 has a decay time of order 10,000 years. I forget if it's 7,000. That means it's really good for dating human settlements, because people make campfires, and you can measure the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 and say, oh, this campfire is 2,000 years old or 20,000 years old. You can't say if it's a million years old, because all the carbon-14 is gone by now. Right? Its half-life is too short. So you have to find an isotope with a sweet spot for what you're trying to measure. For cosmology, these are some of the really heavy metals like uranium and thorium. So europium is something up there in the same part of the periodic table that is stable, but there are isotopes of both uranium and thorium that decay with long times. Thorium is pretty much ideal. Its half-life is 14 billion years.
So there's basically been one half-life for thorium since the beginning of time. So that's in a sweet spot. If you can measure it, then you can age date things, in principle, as accurately as geologists. Of course, we can't go and take a sample and do it in the lab, so we still are limited by how well we can do the spectroscopy and interpret the stellar spectrum. But in principle, this is completely independent. You're just using the nuclear physics as your clock to measure how things are. Uranium-238, that's the nice uranium, right? 235 is what we blew stuff up with. 238 is more common because it has a longer half-life of about 4.5 billion years, so there's still plenty of that around. But it is radioactive. It does decay on that long time scale. I don't remember what the half-life is. 235 is. It's pretty long, but that's the stuff you need to make a bomb. 238 is depleted stuff, what you get rid of if you want to enrich your nuclear fuel. So anyway, stars blow up and they make all these elements, and then you can hope to watch them decay and measure the age, or at least the time since that supernova explosion made these things. All right, so here is the nuclear physicist's chart of the heavy metals. This is proton number against neutron number. So each of these horizontal lines corresponds to one element, and each dot is the different isotopes of that element. It is the same number of protons, but slightly different numbers of neutrons. And that zigzag line is the valley of nuclear stability, as those things are basically stable. Making them is the trick. So this is just the heavy metals. The numbers start at 40 here for neutrons, 20 for protons. So iron-56 falls off the edge of this graph. Right? All the light stuff that we're more familiar with in the periodic table is off to the left here. The There's iron 56.
And that is the heaviest thing you can make by nuclear fusion.
Well, how the heck do you make all this stuff?
There are two primary modes. One is the so-called S process, that's for slow. And there's the R process for rapid. And so basically what happens in the slow process is that elements are exposed to some flux of neutrons over a long period of time in the interiors of stars where all these nuclear reactions are going on to power them. So if you have any pre-existing iron that's mixed in with the core, well, it gets exposed to the neutrons that are kicked loose by fusion, and they basically work their way up this zigzag line. That's the slow process. Just gradual exposure over billions of years in the nuclear reactors that are stars. The rapid process is when something goes boom. Either a supernova that produces all these neutrinos and other things, or the collision of neutron stars. But basically, you have to bathe material in a really dense, rich, neutron-rich environment, just very rapidly exposing stuff to a lot of neutrons. Well, think about this. It's proton versus neutron. These things are stable, so they pre-exist with some abundance. You shine a gazillion neutrons on them, and they all get pushed to the right in this because they absorb some of those neutrons. And that's what this striped region is. This is what the theorists think happened when you get exposed. Time scales of seconds. Right, so this happens in an explosion or something. And then these things are way neutron rich compared to the valley of stability, so they're super radioactive and decay right away.
Are you saying that, so the slow process happens in the star?
Yep.
So, okay, assuming we're starting from iron, do we have to start from iron to go up the slope?
No, I mean, you know, you will have some of these things around all the time. So sometimes you'll have a little bit of this and you can make more. Depends on what the initial composition of the star is.
So before a star can go, you know, go supernova or, you know, become a, you know, nebula or anything, it has things like uranium in it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everything but the first generation of stars. So we, you know, there's population one stars, which are like the sun. Population two stars,
all right,
which are these things. And they have very low metallicities, but not zero. Population three is the hypothetical first generation of stars that were just hydrogen and helium. And they would have blown up on timescales of 10 million years and seeded the rest of the universe with some metals.
When I think of metals, I think of like aluminum.
Yeah.
Like the low ones, but I think the high ones.
Well, exactly, and so I don't actually know offhand how many of these really heavy metals get made in that process. Not nearly as many as the alpha things. The lower, I mean, you're absolutely right, the lower alpha sequence nuclei are the things that mostly get made in that process. Part of the issue is that not only is population three hypothetical, that is, we think there must have really been a time when you only had hydrogen and helium, so that's what the first stars had to be made of. We don't know what those stars were like. Did they form with the same IMF as normal stars? Well, apparently not, because we don't find any, right? The really low mass ones would still be around. There are some super, I mean, people look hard for that. There are some super low metallicity stars that are known. And even a couple that are argued that, you know, if you've just been cruising around in the interstellar medium for 13 billion years, your atmosphere would have collected a little bit of metallicity. So maybe that's a pop-free star that's just been polluted. But they're not garden variety, for sure. And so this gets into the theory of star formation. How do you actually form low metallicity stars? The metals do a lot of the cooling to get you over the Jeans threshold to let the gas cloud collapse. You don't have very many metals, or none at all, you have very little cooling. And so you need a bigger characteristic mass to collapse. That's the, again, the back of the envelope argument that people use a lot to say that the first stars should have been supermassive, not normal mass.
Yeah, it did.
That reasoning should apply to the difference between globular clusters and other stars, and yet they seem to have the same IMF. So, still, it's plausible to think that the top three stars were mostly massive. And as such, they could have done all sorts of crazy stuff, basically. So maybe they did some of this. I don't know. I know there are people who work on it, but I don't really know how much you seed these things as opposed to the stuff that's not even on this graph. And of course, the abundance of these things cosmically is way down from stuff below iron. So it does take a long time to build up, both in the interior of the stars, which then has to get dredged up and blown out into the interstellar medium. Or you have these explosions that fill up this valley, and then they basically decay along these diagonal lines back to the valley of stability here. And so there are some things that you see there, those just are not reached by the S process. Those things were made by the R process. So you can distinguish R process into really heavy things, uranium and the thorium, that's all R process. You just don't get there by S. So we are really talking about the very heavy top end of the or bottom end of the periodic table. And it ain't easy to get there. So there's so much history here, right? So one of the early results in stellar spectroscopy was that the abundance pattern, do I have that? I don't think I do, no. Of the elements, I think I do. Yeah. This pattern, this zigzag pattern, you see that in pretty much all the stars. And that even odd thing is that the even numbered nuclei are more stable than the odd number. And so when you're working your way up this, this S process, since it's gradual, goes to the stable thing first. And so you end up with more even numbered isotopes than you do that. So this zigzag is real. What we have is this S process, the blue part is the R process, and the red is the S process for the solar system. So you can see up here there's a lot of both. When you get to the really heavy atoms, and basically it's not S process anymore, it's all R process.
Right.
But this pattern, high, low, high, low, high, low, that's repeated in all stars. And in the early days of stellar spectroscopy, everything not only showed the same pattern, but they showed the same absolute abundance, because mostly people were working on relatively nearby stars that were all pop ones and like this. So it was for a while thought that this was the primordial abundance. This is what God gave us to work with. You know? And so the early days of primordial nucleosynthesis, which we will talk about in the future, people were thinking you gotta make everything at the beginning, not just right. Now we think the hydrogen was partly turned into helium, and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, you also get a little bit of lithium out of that. And then everything else is made in stars or explosions related to stars. That was not the initial picture. Initially, it's like everything has this pattern, so we better make it all from the beginning. The problem with that is the helium bottleneck and the carbon bottleneck. Those are nuclei that are really stable, and so it's really hard to do anything to them that turns them into something heavier. So, no, I'm good. It's like in chemistry, you have stable shells, and the nobles are stable because they don't want an electron, they don't want to give away an electron, they're good. The same thing for the nuclei, they have shells, helium's really standard, carbon-12's really standard. It's really hard to get past those things. And so, Eugene Wigner was one of the people working on this, as well as George Gamow. And Vera Rubin related to me a story of George Gamow, who was her advisor, at a meeting where Wigner was saying, yeah, I can do all this, here's the calculation. And Gamow pointed out that he had just basically skipped helium. If you get past helium, then you can do all this, but you can't get past helium. So he had a little, I have seen the cartoon, I don't know where it is anymore. picture of Vigner skipping along the elements and just saying, please, let me jump over before I can get along all the other. Vigner was a very polite German man, so he said, Bitte. If you allow. So, you know, the picture was very different, right? That initial picture, and these things do change. And I think we understand this now, but, you know, it's tough. So anyway, the heaviest of the heavies all come from the R process, right? There's all this up here. And so we can actually try to measure it. So here's an example of uranium. Here's stellar spectrum. Notice the super high resolution. If those of you who remember Earl Love, this is the kind of thing he did. You need ridiculously high stellar spectral resolution. This is 3850.5, 3860.5. So this is 2 angstroms. So it's super zoomed in spectrum. And there are all these lines. It's an incredibly rich line. So iron, yeah, that's why we use iron as our first metallicity indicator, because there are just iron lines all over the darn place. But there are other things, and right here is uranium. And notice that it's not really a line so much as kind of a dent in the continuum. So you can see how this gets very hard. The continuum is that long. Well, it's not the continuum, it's a fit. And you're predicting that it would be this in the absence of a uranium line. But you've had to fit it to everything else, and you don't get that perfect everywhere. Because there are all sorts of lines, right? You've all, I presume, been taught the hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics, right? You got one proton, one electron, and an infinity of lines from all those different transitions. Right? That's the simplest case. Think about uranium. This is singly ionized uranium. It's got, you know, hundreds of electrons, thousands of transitions available to them. There's a lot of damn lines out there. But you do see this dent that seems to be due to uranium. And this dotted line shows you what the line would have looked like at the initial abundance of uranium. So the uranium is decaying away, and over time it gets weaker and weaker. So the difference between this, some uranium here, the initial uranium, is what you're looking for. And you have to reference that to some stable isotope. Europium is a common choice. It have to be that, but it's in the same part of the periodic table, so hopefully it all came from the same R process event. And it is an event, right? It was some kind of explosion or collision. Super high nuclear density thing. But so that gives you one way of doing that, and it's hard, but it can be done. Here's an application to thorium. So thorium's way out here. There's uranium. Blue line, that's the solar abundance. And so you're basically looking at the difference between this and this. Of course, you have to normalize it for what the abundance of the particular star is, and so this one has a higher europium abundance than the Sun by a little bit, but a lower thorium abundance. Right? That's because the thorium is decaying and the europium is not. And so you can just work out that it's just radioactive decay. One expects the initial ratio to be 0.48, in the Sun it's 0.46, and in this particular star it's 0.24. Take it back up here and ask how long it takes for that much thorium to decay. 12 or 13 billion years. Since the event that made the thorium, the europium, right, that's independent of the age of the star, it presumably came after the Big Bang, but maybe not long after. So that's really, in some sense, that's the golden standard that is what the geologists can use in the lab. But it's very hard to do that in astronomy. First, you have to find these super low metallicity stars, which is hard. And then you have to measure them extraordinarily well.
Yeah. So is this time, or these times, like it, kind of a lower limit? Because you're just, that's from the event?
Yeah, that's right. This is the age of this object according to, so
like
the universe has to be older than that. And you do have to have time. The object, the leave the event, right? But that can, in principle, be very short, right? A supernova happens after 10 million years. So that's obviously a small part of the air budget.
Gotcha.
You know, we'll talk about structure formation in the future, but it does take some time to go from the very smooth initial condition of the microwave background, which is very homogeneous, to making a star, which is very inhomogeneous. And that's supposed to take a few hundred million years at minimum. So this is, you're right, this is really a lower limit to the age of the universe. Another way, which I only know about because I overlapped with this guy at DKM for a while. Larry Nittler works on meteoritics, so he actually takes meteorites and does the same geology tricks to measuring isotope ratios. And it turns out that there have been missions to collect space dust. Basically, I think Stardust was the name of the mission, and it went up and it had this sort of gel that basically it just exposed the gel to space for a while. Random particles got stuck into it, closed up, came back to Earth. There was an elaborate landing procedure so it wouldn't get contaminated. It was closed up in the shell, and it came back, re-entered, and it was supposed to have its parachutes deploy, slow down enough, and then a helicopter with a hook was going to sweep by and scoop it up before it hit the ground.
Notice I said supposed to.
I was about to start an observing run when it was came back down. So I just came down to breakfast in the hotel I was at before I went up the mountain, and they were showing the live feed. It was coming down. Oh, cool. You know, it was coming down out in the desert, not too far from where I was. And they had a camera on it, and it was just like, looked like a bad UFO. It was just wobbling, wobbling and wobbling. And it's like, yeah, the parachute should deploy anytime now. Yeah, anytime now. Yeah, well, there's the helicopter. It's going to swoop in and wham! Smack into the Earth. The telescope's never, the parachute's never deployed. So that is a risk. Sometimes things don't work.
So can they still do science with
them? Well, that's a really good question. So certainly it was not the clean, gentle landing that was happening. People did it anyway, right? You've done this mission, you had the material. The case was pretty tough, and the claim is that some of the samples were preserved uncontaminated. Mm-hmm. Whether I believe that is another question. But so the point is that people can do this sort of thing, and the neat thing in these kinds of missions is that sometimes you catch dust grains that you can tell how fast they hit by the impression they make on the gel. They came in on hyperbolic orbits. That is, they were not bound to the sun. They were grains from outside the solar system. So they were made in some other star and just happened to be passing through. Yeah.
So I guess they don't know anything about like the trajectory. They just knew like the absolute speed. And then they could tell it was bound.
You know a little bit about the trajectory, but certainly not enough to say where it came from.
That's very cool.
And so there are a collection of these things that have isotopic ratios that seem to have been made in the interiors of red giant stars that have a period of dredge up. So right, the nuclear reaction is going on deep inside the star, and most of that never sees the surface, much less interstellar space. Okay. But red giants become very convective, and that stirs things up. Mostly that convection is outside the core, and again, you never mix. Once in a while, there are phases of stellar evolution where the convective layer becomes deep enough that you're actually reaching into that nuclear process material, dredging it up, as it said, and then that stuff eventually does find interstellar space. And you can calculate what, not just how much oxygen is made, but what the ratio of 18 oxygen 17 oxygen, normal 16 oxygen is. And you can measure that really precisely if you can get a sample into the lab. And so there's a collection of these things that are consistent with having been made in a red giant stars. And then you can age date the grain with the usual radioactive things. And so you can get basically the age by combining all this. Well, how long has the sun been here? How long did it take to mix that stuff into the interstellar medium? That's sort of a lower limit, we think, but probably not a lot longer than that. How long did it take the star that made the grain to have evolved to the point where it could make the grain? About 5 giga years. And you add all that up, and again, it's 14 giga years. So all these different methods give you a consistent answer as to what the age is. They're not independent. They're all dependent at some level on stellar evolution, except for the radioactive chronometers. And that's why I say those are, in principle, the gold standard. You don't really need to know where the radioactive thorium and uranium came from. You just need to know their half-lives and measure their abundances accurately enough to make use of that information, which is the hard part. And for that, you do have to understand stars and fit their spectra right, which is really involved. But it can be done. And the impressive thing to me is that these all give numbers in the same range, around 13 billion years, which is close to the age of the universe according to the Hubble time. Can't be two-thirds of that. Okay, other questions? Okay, I think that is quite enough for today then. If you want a solution, the homework, come on up and we'll work on stapling them together.